Today we're looking at Matthew chapter 17 from verse 14 to 27, page 872. When they reached the crowd, a man approached and knelt before him. "Lord," he said, "have mercy on my son, because he has seizures and suffers terribly. He often falls into the fire and often into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they couldn't heal him." Jesus replied, "You unbelieving and perverse generation, how long will I be with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring him here to me." Then Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and from that moment the boy was healed. Then the disciples approached Jesus privately and said, "Why couldn't we drive it out?" "Because of your little faith," he told them. "For truly I tell you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you'll tell this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you." As they were gathering together in Galilee, Jesus told them, "The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day he'll be raised up." And they were deeply distressed. When they came to Capernaum, those who collected the temple tax approached Peter and said, "Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax?" "Yes," he said. When he went into the house, Jesus spoke to him first. "What do you think, Simon? From whom do earthly kings collect tariffs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers?" "From strangers," he said. "Then the sons are free," Jesus told him. "But, so we won't offend them, go to the sea, cast in a fish hook and take the first fish that you catch. When you open its mouth, you'll find a coin. Take it and give it to them for me and you." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. What, Jesus, do you trust in? What, Jesus, do you trust in? It seems a strange question to ask. After all, we all trust in Jesus, don't we? But it's actually an important question, because I think that's the question Matthew's asking now. As we make a discerning decision about Jesus, as we look at all the facts that God has laid before us, as Jesus is and as Jesus has come, I think Matthew is asking us this question. What, Jesus, do you trust in? Some people trust in a Jesus who will make their life smooth. A Jesus will remove obstacles, kind of like a snowplow that goes ahead of them, protect them from hardship, and make everything cruisy. Some people want to trust or do trust in a Jesus who's a rabble-rouser, a man who stirs up the system, upsets the apple cart, throws over the establishment, and causes fights everywhere. Some people trust in a Jesus who's a mate, a bloke who'll sit with them at the table of knowledge and ruminate about life's mysteries and have a cuppa with them. Some people trust in a Jesus who'll give them a recipe for life, a format to succeed, and then just send them off so that they can conquer the world and be all they want to be. What, Jesus, do you trust in? Let me pray. Father, thanks for your word. Thanks for Matthew. That's amazing to think of this man who was so far on the outside that he was hated by his own and hated by his employers. A man who was lonely, but a man who was made whole by meeting Jesus as he truly is. Jesus, the one who was promised by God, the King, come to bring the outsider in. Father, please help us to meet this Jesus today. Father, please help us to trust in this Jesus. And please help us to present this Jesus to the world without obstacle, without stumbling block, so that others may come to know and love him. Amen. We're at the central part of Matthew's Good News biography of Jesus. And at this point, this is what we know about Jesus. He's the King promised by God to bring the outsider in. The one promised by God to restore a world broken by our rebellion. Over the last few weeks, when we think back into last year, we've seen Jesus as he is, we've seen Jesus as he has come, and we've looked at what that means. Jesus is the King promised by God. As we saw last week, he's God himself in the flesh, the one to whom all history points. Jesus is the King who promised to deal with our sin, whom God said would stand in for us to be judged for the sins of his people, the one King who'll be rejected and killed by his own mob and then rise from the dead. This Jesus is actually going to build God's mob. This Jesus is the one that God's mob will follow, footstep after footstep. This Jesus is the King we must listen to. And as God's people, it kind of sometimes seems like a bit of a roller coaster following this King, doesn't it? I mean, if you think about it, we often have moments like last week. Moments where we seem to just capture who Jesus is in all of his glory and wonder, and all these pennies drop and these light bulbs go on. And then the very next moment, what happens? We seem to face plant into planet Earth, don't we? If not planet Earth, at least our own sinful hearts. Life as God's people's like that, isn't it? From those mountaintops to those face plants. Jesus has been with Peter, James and John on the mountaintop. There he's been revealed as God in the flesh. It is just an amazing passage, isn't it? Just seeing God in the flesh. And there we've seen him standing with Moses and Elijah. There we've heard God say, "This is my boy. I love him. I'm delighted in him. Listen to him." It's all been done for the disciples, the three who were there and us listening. What a high. When they reached the crowd, a man approached and knelt before him. "Lord," he said, "have mercy on my son because he has seizures and suffers terribly. He often falls into the fire and often into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they couldn't heal him." A man has a sick boy. The sick boy has seizures. It seems to have an evil component because the seizures always take him to fire and water. His son is suffering. He's brought his son to the other nine disciples waiting at the bottom of the mountain, and they couldn't heal him. What a high. What a face plant. And Jesus is exasperated. Look at verse 17. Jesus replied, "You unbelieving and perverse generation, how long will I be with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring him here to me." Seems like Jesus has just done his nana, hasn't it? It's a harsh response. Seems overly critical from the one who loves humans, doesn't it? The Son of God. Until you actually dig a little deeper. You see, I think Jesus is actually quoting Deuteronomy 32 verse 5. He's describing God's people in front of him just like Moses did. Moses is there with God's people on the border of the promised land. He's at the end of three sermons that he's preached to God's people. And they're about to enter into the promised land. And Moses sings his last song. Now, that's what we read. That's what Penny read for us from Deuteronomy 32. Moses sings his last song. And in that song, he reminds God's people of who they are and who God is. Now, if you remember what Penny read, he actually kicks off by saying, "Look how good God is. God is always steadfast. God is always faithful. God is always pure. God is the rock, immovable, always loving." And that image, did you hear that image of how God found his people in a desolate land with wind blowing and sand stinging their face? And God took them and God said, "You're my mob." Generous. Kind, loving, persevering, faithful, gracious, endlessly. God's people? A wicked and perverse people. At the very moment when God is demonstrating what he's like, if you know the Old Testament, they're saying, "Thanks God, but we want the stew in Egypt. Thanks God, but we want the pomegranates back there in slavery. Thanks God, but we can do things under our own steam." What a contrast. Here is God, and here are his people. God has constantly lavished his affection on them, his provision, his care. And God's people, they either doubt him, or once they are set on their feet, they go, well, actually, God, we'll take it from here. And they turn back to themselves. Who do God's people really trust? In that sense, I think Jesus is speaking to the 12. He's turned to them and he's quoted to them from the Song of Moses. And the wider crowd is listening in. That actually kind of sharpens what Jesus is saying. He's speaking to the 12. Those men have accompanied him throughout his whole earthly work. They've seen his power. They've seen his grace. They've seen his kindness. They've seen his generosity. And in fact, way back there in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus chose this 12 and said, I'm going to give you my authority. My authority over unclean spirits to drive them out, to heal every disease and sickness. Matthew 10 verse 1. They've walked with him. They've watched him. They've been granted authority by him. And they are a wicked and perverse generation, because they are doing just as God's people did in the Old Testament. We've got it from here, Jesus. Or despite what we've seen, I just don't think you're going to deliver the goods, Jesus. Can you understand Jesus' exasperation? It's a godly exasperation. Just as Moses and God were exasperated there on the border of the Promised Land, who do you really trust in? Bring him here to me. Then Jesus rebuked the demon. It came out of him, and from that moment the boy was healed. Do you want to know who Jesus is? What power and authority does he have? From that moment the boy was well. From that moment the boy was well. Privately his disciples come to him with a question. And it's here we actually start to dive into what's actually going on here. Look there in verse 19. Then the disciples approached Jesus privately. I would have. Very privately. And they said, why couldn't we drive it out? There's the issue, isn't it? Where's the issue? It's that personal pronoun. We. Why couldn't we drive it out? You can kind of reimagine that image there at the bottom of the hill. Remember, Jesus is up the top of the hill with Peter, James and John, and the other nine are hanging down the bottom. If it was a Western, they'd just be leaning against the doorpost, just, you know, so everyone can see them. And a man approaches with this boy. Are you Jesus' disciples? That we are. Can you please heal my boy? That we can. And then the swagger and the self-confidence and the words that they'd trusted in last time just don't work now, do they? Because they're actually not trusting in the one who gave them authority. Of course we can heal him. No, we cannot deal with this at all. And Jesus' answer to their question is striking. And we must pay attention. You see, again, Matthew does something interesting. He suddenly puts Jesus' answer in the present tense. It's suddenly put way into the foreground. Okay, there are only two present tense verbs in this passage, and they're both the same word. We'll get to the other one in a moment. But here it is very clear. Because of your little faith, Jesus says, not told, says. And so we're meant to listen and be confronted by the same answer. Let me read it again. Because of your little faith. That rebuke's common enough in Matthew. Matthew chapter 6 verse 30, Matthew chapter 8 verse 26, Matthew chapter 14 verse 31. Jesus has used this rebuke again and again, and it's a comment on the fact that their dependence is misplaced. Their dependence is misplaced. Their dependence isn't in the one they've walked with, but in some other version of him. And in this case, themselves. Their trust in Jesus has been moved. In a moment of vacillation, a moment where they're wavering, a moment where they think, no, I've got this, it's moved from Jesus to where? To we. And in that sense, Jesus' explanation is very helpful. The issue with their faith isn't its size. Do you notice that? Because Jesus then goes on to talk about having faith that's only this big. So the issue isn't the size of their faith. The issue is where their faith is placed, on whom they are dependent. They've moved from God's king to we. They've moved from God's king to pretend kings. If they did depend on Jesus, it only needs to be as big as a mustard seed, because it's Jesus. And again, don't misread this. Don't think Jesus is now saying, you've got a blank check to do whatever you do. If you trust me, I'll just go and move mountains for you any day of the week. No. It's an example from the extreme. If you depend on the right king, if you depend on the right king, the whole section is focused on Jesus and the disciples. Right the way through this, that's where our focus is meant to be. The key moments are in private. The key messages are for those disciples of Jesus. And at this moment of discernment, Jesus wants to confront his disciples and say, which Jesus do you trust in? In that sense, trust or faith is a belief that's acted upon. Have you seen what I'm like, gentlemen? Have you seen what I can do? Have you seen what I'm serious about? Have you seen that I do exactly as I say? Which Jesus do you trust in? And at this moment, as his father and boy have come forward, on whom did the disciples depend? We've got this. And it reveals which Jesus they trust in or don't trust in. We've got this. And Jesus wants to ask us the same question. Which Jesus do you trust in? Who do you trust in? Jesus had shown these men the moves. Now they took matters into their own hands, just standing there at the foot of the mountain. Who knows what's going up on the top? Off they go and they come face planting back into earth. It was themselves they trusted in, wasn't it? Even as they dressed it up as Jesus. Do you think we can ever be the same? We trust in Jesus, don't we? And then we take matters into our own hands. Or we trust in a Jesus we manufacture. Didn't Jesus say this? Well, why hasn't he done it? We trust in a Jesus who will serve us, who agrees with us, who panders to our expectations and plans. Which Jesus do we trust in? Well, they're now firmly moving towards Jerusalem. And at point three on the outline, they're moving from way up the top of the country and they're starting to make their way down. And as they do make their way down, we don't know whether it's on the same day or a little later, they gather together in Galilee, verse 22, and Jesus told them, the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men. They'll kill him. On the third day, he'll be raised up. And they were deeply distressed. It's the second statement Jesus has made about what will happen to him. It's briefer, it's blunter, it's more imminent, it's about to be just as necessary. But did you notice the importance doesn't change? Jesus as God in the flesh will be betrayed, killed and rise from the dead. This is the Jesus to trust in. Here's the answer to the question that we've just been posed. This is the Jesus to trust in. God in the flesh who will die. God in the flesh who will be crucified by and for his enemies. And then what will he do 3 days later? He'll walk out of the tomb. He will conquer death. And so have all authority and power to heal the brokenness that we struggle with. Is that the Jesus we trust in? Even in this short period from Matthew 16 to 17, do you notice a change in the disciples? The last time Jesus said this, what did they do? Hey, Jesus, wrong revolutionary plan. Now what do they do? They're deeply distressed. They're starting to grasp the big picture, though I don't think they've quite grasped the importance of it. And that question keeps bubbling away. Is this the Jesus you trust in? They're now in Capernaum at point four on the outline. When they came to Capernaum, those who collect the temple tax approached Peter and said, "Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax?" "Yes," Peter said. "They're as far north of Jerusalem. Even there you can't avoid the tax collectors." Sound familiar? And they're the tax collectors for the temple tax. This was a tax paid by every male, and it went to the temple around the time of Passover. And they approached Peter. I don't know why they approached Peter instead of Jesus. They approached Peter and asked him a question. It's not a wicked question. They're expecting a yes answer. It's just, "Hey, you guys going to pay the tax?" How does Peter answer? "Of course we're going to pay the tax." Again, it's in the present tense. Now, I've been really grappling with this. I don't quite know what's going on here, but I think Peter is at least saying, along with us, "Yeah, that's the one I follow." Yeah, that kind of king. And then we find out a little bit more about what kind of king that is. Now look there in verse 25. When he went into the house, Jesus spoke to him first. "What do you think, Simon? From whom do earthly kings collect tariffs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers?" "From strangers," he said. "Then the sons are free," Jesus told him. "But so we won't offend them, go to the sea, cast in a fish hook, take the first fish that you catch, and when you open its mouth, you'll find a coin. Take it and give it to them for me and you." Now, notice who's Jesus speaking to? Peter, in the house, just for the disciples. Jesus uses an image. Whom do earthly kings tax? They don't tax their own family. They tax everyone else. And Jesus then makes the conclusion, well, the family's free. And we start to understand what Jesus is on about. After all, who's the temple pointing to? Jesus. Who's the king? Jesus. Who are his family? These 12. Well, if anyone's not going to pay the temple tax, it's the bloke to whom the temple points to. Why should Jesus pay the tax? He's everything the Old Testament is. If there's one bloke who didn't have to pay this tax, who is it? It's Jesus. But what does Jesus do? He uses that immense power in order not to offend. Did you notice that? He uses that immense power to pay a tax so he won't offend anyone. We don't want to scandalize them. We don't want to put a stumbling block in front of them. We want them to actually understand who I am. So the one bloke who didn't have to pay the tax, what does he do? He goes ahead and he pays the tax. Well, that is an amazing king, isn't it? A king who uses his immense power so that he puts no stumbling block in front of anyone. A king who uses his immense power so he doesn't distract people from who he really is. At no point does Jesus stand on his own rights. At no point does Jesus use his power for his benefit. He knows who he is, and then he acts so that everyone else can meet him as he is, with no stumbling block, no impediment, no scandal. It's very different to those 9 who stood at the bottom of the hill and put themselves in front of Jesus, didn't they? What Jesus do you trust in? I'm at the last point. What does following him look like? The Jesus in Matthew's Good News biography is remarkable. He's God in the flesh, the king who'll die for his people, the king who'll be rejected by his people, killed by his people, and conquer death for his people. That's the king we need to meet. And that's the king who conducts himself in such a way so that there are no stumbling blocks in front of him. So you can meet him as he truly is. Is that the Jesus we trust in? Is that the Jesus we follow? Now, when I ask those 2 questions, I think Matthew is pushing us to honestly consider the Jesus we trust in. Is it the one we meet here? Or is it another Jesus? A Jesus we've created, a Jesus we've replaced, a Jesus we've manufactured. If this is the Jesus we trust in, do we actually depend upon him? Or are we like the disciples and we'll say all these things, but when we've got the opportunity in front of a crowd, we'll just take matters into our own hands. Thank you very much. Even more than this, is this the Jesus we present to the world? Without obstacles from our own conduct, without distractions from our own discipleship, without a misguided focus on our own rights and privileges. Is this the Jesus we trust in? And so is this the Jesus we speak to the world? Let me be very clear. There's no other Jesus that can save the world, is there? There's no other Jesus our world needs. And we must place no obstacle to people meeting this Jesus. No obstacle at all. Is there any other Jesus worth trusting? Let me pray. Father, thank you for Jesus. Thank you for having such a clear picture of him. Help us to depend upon him. Help us to proclaim him as he truly is, because there is no other salvation for this world. In Jesus' name, amen. Any quick questions? Baxter.
Tell us an obstacle that we might accidentally face in our thinking today.
Baxter's asked a good question. Can I bring forth an obstacle that we might place in front of people today? Okay. So I think two come to mind. Okay. Two come to mind. The first is, we might present a Jesus that's not actually in the Bible. Maybe a Jesus who's more Anglican or Presbyterian or congregational. Okay. And that's really important, because Jesus is as he is in the Bible. We want people to meet Jesus in the Bible. Okay. Not as we dress him up in our denomination, which we can easily do. And so one of the things when people come to me and say, how do I meet Jesus? Read Mark's Gospel. Mark's Gospel, 16 chapters you can read in an hour. You can spend an hour meeting Jesus. So that'd be the first one. I think for someone like me, and I don't know if other people are the same, the Jesus that I follow, I don't always follow wholeheartedly. And so I can often present to the world a Jesus who accepts that I might want to dibble-dabble, dip in and out. And so he's a Jesus that doesn't claim all of me. He's a Jesus that just claims some of me. And so my discipleship can be a distraction from the real Jesus. And so that's a constant prayer. How is my discipleship of Jesus presenting the real Jesus, the one who saves all of me by giving all of him so that all of me follows him? Does that make sense? So there are probably two obstacles that we can put in front of the world. Any other quick questions? Warwick.
Without going through any distractions, without any rabbit holes,
what's the significance of the fish? It's a great question. No rabbit holes. I've never seen a fish down a rabbit hole. But what's the significance? I think there are probably three. I think Jesus has a terrific sense of humour. Isn't it good to follow a king that's got a sense of humour? Jesus could produce the tax anyway, couldn't he? But he's followed by a bunch of people he's going to turn into fishers of men who are fishermen. So what better way to do it? Go and throw out. So it's a one. So he's got a sense of humour. I think secondly, it's within Peter's wheelhouse. Peter's a fisherman. Okay, so he's speaking to Peter. It's in Peter's language. I think thirdly, it displays his immense power. Here is the king to whom all the temple points, who doesn't have to pay the temple tax, who now exercises that immense power by actually just using creation. So no stumbling blocks. So I think those three things are happening. Does that answer? Yep.